interests are always going to align with the United States. And that's a big bet at a time when politics in the United States has never been so fragile. I mean, we're potentially just 3 years away from Donald Trump being re-elected or a Donald Trump-style figure being re-elected, whereas this technology locks us in to really the United States' plans for the Indo-Pacific for decades to come.
One for Mum, one for Dad, and one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be an Australian.
Budgets are about choices, Fran, and you show what you value through the choices you make.
Dead, buried, cremated.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
The treasurer.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
How good is Australia?
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, and today we're going to be talking about Australia's new nuclear submarines pact, which has sent shockwaves around the globe.
Australia is embarking on its most significant change of defence and strategic direction in decades, aiming to make the next fleet of submarines nuclear powered.
Position Australia in the best and strongest way possible, and to contribute to the stability and security of our region that will benefit all in our region. No exceptions.
A diplomatic row has broken out over a new defence and security partnership between Britain, America and Australia.
Prompted by Australia's sudden cancellation of a €30 billion submarine contract last week, which is now threatening to derail Australia's trade deal with the EU.
The White House can't even secure a phone call to the Elysee Palace.
The President will have a call, it has yet. We're still working on the scheduling of it.
The Prime Minister's trip to Jakarta has been cancelled in the fallout over the AUKUS defence pact.
Foreign Minister Maurice Payne was denied a meeting with her French counterpart in New York today.
Australia had a $90 billion contract with France to build up to 12 submarines. But that deal has now been scrapped, and US President Joe Biden announced that the US-UK would enter into a new trilateral security partnership, awkwardly dubbed AUKUS, that part of that deal would be building Australia nuclear-powered submarines. The deal not only caught France by surprise, and there's already been considerable blowback on that front, but it came as a complete surprise to the Australian public, not to mention our neighbours in the Pacific and Asia. It's a bit of an earth-shattering announcement that will have economic, political and strategic ramifications for really decades to come. So today I'm delighted to begin that conversation with our guests Ben Oquist, Executive Director of the Australia Institute, and Alan Beam, Director of the Australia Institute's International and Security Affairs Program. G'day, Ben and Alan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ebony. Thanks, Alan.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Ben, before we kind of get into the details of this deal, I mean, this isn't really a question, but it's such a huge announcement, and it just seemed to come out of nowhere.
Yeah, it's good to start at the beginning and actually discuss what it is and why it's so significant and why it's not just the French that have been blindsided by the announcement and why the Australian public have effectively been blindsided by the announcement. Of course, it's up to prime ministers and governments to make policy announcements all the time. But one as genuinely momentous as this is hard to remember, with such wide-ranging ramifications as you've outlined in your introduction. And going back to the start, it is, as you've rightly described it, officially an enhanced trilateral security partnership aimed at deepening diplomatic security and defence cooperation in the Indo-Pacific region. And, of course, the first step of that is to have Australia join a small club of nations. There's only six others in the world, UK, US, China, Russia, India and France, in having nuclear-powered submarines. But as you've outlined, I think as much as the detail is important, it's important to start by noting that the government has made a huge announcement with really no debate in Australia about it altogether. Mm. And this is despite the fact that, of course, there is no rush Just focusing on the submarines for a moment, the plan is to build or own or operate nuclear subs for Australia. And if we're to build them, we won't have them for 20 years. And in fact, there's going to be 18 months of planning to decide what type of nuclear subs we build. So this huge decision that essentially locks Australia into a trajectory that denies the country the opportunity to have a more independent foreign policy, that locks us into US strategic aims in the region, has been made with no debate in Australia. And we haven't, you know, let alone considered the financial and economic ramifications of a decision which the Prime Minister has said, basically, we will spend whatever it takes, with all the effects that has on future taxation policy in Australia or spending policy or debt and deficit policy. So just think about this for one second. The government has said we're going to spend whatever it takes. These subs are going to cost more than the $90 billion we already had scheduled for the French subs, and we've got the costs of tearing up that contract and the proliferation of other defence equipment associated with this defence pact. Now, one of three things has to happen there to pay for it. We have to cut spending somewhere else, we have to raise taxes somewhere else, or we have to increase debt somewhere else, and there's been no discussion of that, let alone what it means for Australian foreign policy and our relationships with other countries in the region. So I think it's worth just noting that we the government has brought this on the Australian public with no forewarning, no democratic debate, despite, of course, the implications being for decades to come, and despite the fact that we've got plenty of time to debate these things before locking them in, the government's rushing ahead.
Yeah. We might come back to a few of those points that you've raised there, Ben, but Alan, on the actual substance of the deal, what do we know about the deal itself? What are the advantages of a nuclear-powered sub, for example, over a conventional one? Do we actually know much about what's on the table here?
Well, we don't know a huge amount about this deal yet because we simply have not got a design. But there are some fundamental things that we do know. We know, for example, that nuclear-powered submarines have got much greater range and endurance than conventional ones. They can get from point A to point B very, very much more quickly. A conventional submarine underwater travels at about walking speed, whereas a nuclear-powered submarine underwater travels at about 50 kilometres an hour. So there's quite a lot of difference in speed and range. They're also much more habitable, so that if you've got to live in a very uncomfortable place for 2 and a bit months, you'd probably be better off in a nuclear submarine because at least you can shower more frequently. But that being said, they are very, very big vessels. They come in at more than 8,000 tonnes, which means that they are evidently much more visible in certain circumstances than conventional ones, which come in between 3 and 4,000 tonnes. So not everything that a conventional submarine can do could a nuclear-powered submarine do simply because it's so much bigger. Conventional-powered submarines in the design that we originally had for the Collins class and then for the short-fin Barracuda, that is the French design, they were really meant for us to be able to operate in the direct defence of Australia so that we could deal with any adversary's vessels once they came within the waters that Australia controls. These submarines are optimised as nuclear attack hunter-killer submarines, which means that they're specifically designed to take out the ballistic missile submarines of a possible adversary, which puts them into the game of fighting nuclear-powered countries so that you can take away from them their second strike.
As a layperson, what is a second strike capability for people who don't know?
Right. If country A decides to fire nuclear bombs at country B and take out their primary strike, that is the silo-based rocket strike that they would have, the second strike or the defensive strike is a submarine one which moves around underwater and fires nuclear weapons on the tip of rockets that come from underwater. And those submarines are very powerful. They do have a strong deterrent effect. But the sort of submarine that we're talking about, the Astute class in the case of Britain and the Virginia class in the case of the United States, they're optimised for destroying ballistic missile submarines.
And so that's why we were saying, you know, it's quite a small club of countries that actually have and operate these types of nuclear-powered submarines.
Yes, that's right. But because they were designed specifically to interfere with an adversary's second strike capability, so only nuclear weapon states hitherto have found a need to have this kind of submarine. So as Ben pointed out, Australia now becomes the first non-nuclear weapon country to invest in nuclear propulsion for its submarine fleet. And that, I think, can only be premised on a wish to move away from the direct defence of Australia, that is, defending ourselves in the sea air gap to the north and in the oceanic approaches in the east and the west, to taking warfare to the front door of a potential adversary. So that takes us back to what used to be called forward defence.
Britain and America will help Australia build a fleet of new nuclear-powered, though not nuclear-armed, submarines.
They don't need to be refuelled and they don't need to come up for air and can therefore stay underwater for longer. Endurance.
It's not just billions of taxpayer dollars at stake in Australia's French submarine debacle. Up to 750 jobs are also in doubt.
Whatever the value of the AUKUS alliance, it has left Australia without a plan for any sovereign submarine capability for the next 20 years.
So, Ben, what Alan's outlining there is quite a big strategic shift, really. Do you think we've really grasped yet some of the implications of this deal in the long term for Australia? You were talking about the fact that it really closes off a much more independent path for Australia when it comes to foreign policy and defence policy.
Well, essentially it's locking us into a much tighter alliance with the US that really seeks to serve more the United States' interests in the Indo-Pacific. Now, Australia can have submarines, but they don't need to be nuclear-powered. Alan's outlined some of the different types of submarines that there are and the different uses for them. The reality is that these submarines are much more useful to operate further afield from Australia's shores for defence, not defence. Now, others have pointed out if we wanted subs that were focused on defending Australia, you might choose a larger fleet of smaller subs that operate closer to home. And you might choose submarines that didn't lock you into having to be used with other countries. Essentially, these submarines with their nuclear technology mean that we will have to use them with the United States or with the United Kingdom or both. We're essentially denying ourselves a sovereign capability that we could use in our own needs. Now, that's a big bet that our interests are always going to align with the United States. And that's a big bet at a time when politics in the United States has never been so fragile. I mean, we're potentially just 3 years away from Donald Trump being re-elected or a Donald Trump-style figure being re-elected, whereas this technology locks us in to really the United States' plans for the Indo-Pacific for decades to come. Now, it could be that our interests are aligned, but who knows that far down the track whether they will be. And we're really locking us into that trajectory rather than seeking a more independent path. Now, of course, Australia does have an alliance with the United States, but that doesn't mean that we have to do everything the United States does. And in a sense, through the war on terror in Afghanistan and Iraq, of course, Australia was a partner with the United States, but really a marginal partner. We weren't central to it. And that allowed Australia to pursue its own relationships, its own engagements with other countries. But this, of course, will continue to be able to do that, but this makes it much harder to do that in our region. And I think France is just the tip of the iceberg, and the diplomatic meltdown that has occurred is already having ramifications. The Prime Minister's off for meetings in the United States, and there was a plan trilateral to go ahead between Britain, the United States and Australia, and that's now not happening because the optics are so bad of it.
Yeah.
You've seen France recall its ambassador concerns in Indonesia, New Zealand, many places in the region. But the reality is we're now seemingly locked into a path that ties us much closer to the US and makes it much more difficult for us to have independent relations with other countries.
Yeah. And Alan, the reason that we would be so reliant on the United States is partly because we don't have a nuclear power industry here. So we'd be relying on the states to provide training to people to help build them for maintenance, all those kinds of things. Is that right?
Yes, we wouldn't be relying on ourselves to build them or to maintain them or to dispose of them, actually. These new power reactors they have very, very long life. They last the life of the submarine. But Ben's point is the right one, and that is that in acquiring this with a propulsion system over which we have no controls whatsoever, we are ceding an enormous amount of our own sovereignty. And we are signalling that we are going along with whoever provides this submarine. It could be Britain, it could be the United States, but we're going along with them in the fundamental design of the vessel for purposes which are about their national interests. So you could argue that you are also ceding a fair bit of your sovereignty simply because a vessel which is designed primarily for the interests of another country then becomes your vessel, delivering your interests as a kind of second thought.
And Alan, I was going to ask, talked about the fact that only a small number of countries have access to this. Presumably this deal with Australia will mean other countries would also lack access to this, to nuclear-powered submarines.
I think there are two parts to that problem, Ebony, and both of them are, I think, equally alarming. The first part is that strong military powers that have already got a very big toe in the water of submarine capability, and in our region, that's particularly South Korea and Japan, and both of them allies of the United States, could well now think, well, if the Australians, as an ally, a non-nuclear weapon state ally of the United States, are going to get this benefit, why not us? And I would expect that there'll be a fair bit of pushing and shoving prospectively by Japan and by South Korea to do exactly that. The second part of it, though, is in a way it's equally worrying, and the signals are out there already. The former foreign minister of Indonesia, Martin Nuttallegawa, who actually is pretty well disposed to Australia, has already belled the cat and said, this has got very profound implications for ASEAN, and ASEAN's got to step up to this because it could precipitate an arms race here. And he's been backed in that by the foreign minister of Malaysia, who, it is reported, said exactly that to Prime Minister Morrison when Prime Minister Morrison rang him last week.
Mm.
So it's not as though the Southeast Asians have not already advised Australia that there are implications and consequences from this which have not yet been brought to book.
A diplomatic slap over the submarine spat. France withdraws its diplomats.
When you betray somebody, don't expect to be thanked for that.
The question of trust is now occurring, and some members could ask for more safety nets, for more safeguards in such a...
French European Affairs Secretary Clément Beaune said the EU-Australia Free Trade Agreement was off.
One of our member states has been treated in a way that is not acceptable. So we want to know what happened and why.
When did you directly tell President Macron that you were tearing up this contract?
The night before.
The night before it happened?
About 8:30, slightly after 8:30 on the night prior to the announcement.
Ben, I wanted to come back to the cost, but just sticking with those other implications, really the fallout of this deal. Alan there has talked about some of the implications in our region with ASEAN partners, but you alluded to the fact that France had withdrawn its ambassador or recalled it. I'm not quite sure what the terms are for that. I heard on the radio this morning someone from the EU talking about what this will do to Australia's prospects for a free trade agreement with the EU. The fallout from this announcement really hasn't finished yet. France, I'm assuming, will also be looking to make Australia's life difficult on things like a carbon border adjustment mechanism. There's multiple implications that are yet to happen, I'd imagine.
Yeah, and I think it's good to step back and look at the big picture there. And something that France has said will ring true for a lot of countries, that Australia is not a trusted partner, that this was really sprung on France. It wasn't just the cancelling of the sub deal, but it was the secrecy that had gone on behind the scenes and the duplicity. Because France had been attempting to engage with Australia as part of its strategic efforts in the Indo-Pacific region. Remember that France holds great store by its role in the region. You know, it has some 7,000 troops, 2 million citizens, you know, the islands in, you know, including its territories in New Caledonia. So it has a big, long-established presence in the region, and its relationship with Australia through these subs and was part of a wider connection with the region. So it really feel its whole approach has been undermined and it can't trust Australia. And as others have pointed out, if you can't trust Australia on this, can you really trust Australia on trade? Can you really trust Australia on climate? So there's a whole lot of diplomatic and foreign policy fallout still to come. You mentioned the trade agreement to start with and the proposed free trade agreement with the EU. And already we know it is going to be delayed as a result of this. So there will be an economic cost already for some sectors of the Australian economy simply by that delay. And undoubtedly, there will have to be stronger controls and stronger regulations, potentially less concessions to Australia agriculture. So those implications, just the trade implications for Australia are potentially profound. But I guess in an overall sense, the belief that Australia cannot be trusted, I think, is going to be a problem for our diplomats and foreign policy for a long time to come.
I want to come back to that issue of cost, Alan. So this original submarine deal with France was worth $90 billion. I didn't realise we could just rip up a $90 billion contract. And as Ben mentioned, it kind of seems like we're writing a blank cheque to the United States. How much is this deal likely to cost us?
Look, nobody knows at this point. $90 billion for the French submarines was essentially the acquisition cost. The through life and operating cost, you can easily double that. So that, you know, to get out of the French submarine deal as real ongoing costs for less than, say, $200 billion, you'd be doing very well. This submarine acquisition, we don't know how much the unit cost is going to be, and that's essentially because both the Astute class and the Virginia class have come to the end of their builds. So the British have already mentioned that they would be very happy to design a new nuclear-powered attack submarine, and I dare say the Americans would be in the same boat. So when you start putting design costs into an acquisition, this is no off-the-shelf acquisition. This is not going down and buying yourself some kind of Toyota that's already in production. This is having somebody totally design you one and then deliver you 8 copies of it. So we don't know anything about the cost, and it'd be imprudent of me to speculate too wildly. But I think that if you want to imagine what the boundary acquisition cost would be, I think it'd be pretty fair to double the cost of the short fin Barracuda.
Ben, that's just kind of, it's shocking to me that the government has just walked away from this contract, given particularly the rhetoric from many, many Liberal governments around debt and deficit and being careful with taxpayers' money and the like. This, I think, will now head to Parliament for inquiries and various kind of responses to it. But how much do you think taxpayers are going to care about the cost, or do we just kind of write this off as, oh, well, it's defence and we need it, therefore the cost doesn't matter?
Well, in the end, the chickens will come home to roost. The government has said they will pay whatever it takes, but they don't know how much that will be. the subs are just part of this increased defence spending and cooperation with the United Kingdom and the United States. Already we've had commitments from the government to spend at least 2% of Australia's equivalent of GDP on defence spending, and the Prime Minister has now said we'll be going up from there, but with no actual quantum there. But it is a commitment to spend more as a proportion of the economy on GDP. Now, that can only mean three things, as we touched on before, that we're going to have to either increase taxes to pay for it, we're going to have to cut funding from elsewhere, or we're going to have to increase the debt and deficit. And while nobody's worrying about our debt and deficit at the moment, rightly, because we're in the middle of a pandemic and the economic crisis has necessitated extra government spending, there's no doubt that if re-elected, a centre-right government is going to be under pressure to address debt and deficit. Now, if they're under pressure to address debt and deficit, and they've gone to the election saying we'll always be reducing taxes, that only leaves one avenue, and that's to cut spending elsewhere. And I think that realisation has in no way dawned upon the Australian public, and we've had no debate about it. Yes, there'll be Senate and parliamentary inquiries into some of this, but it's all coming after the announcement. And I think, big picture, that's the big democratic shock of this announcement, that something so significant can be foisted on the Australian public without a parliamentary debate beforehand, without a public debate beforehand. And there wasn't a need for that kind of secrecy. And there was a need to take the Australian public into these discussions. They're going to affect not just this generation, but many generations to come.
We all recognise the imperative of ensuring peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific.
It was a tough decision. It was a decision that we knew clearly would cause disappointment.
It's not exclusionary, it's not divisive.
We were deliberately kept in the black.
It is not in our national interest to, you know, make our friends so angry and so disappointed. I mean, I can understand what the French would be asking with friends like this who needs enemies.
Alan, Labor has, I guess, cautiously supported this announcement. The Greens are pretty vociferously opposed. Ben's just said, you know, this has got a long way to go and this is all going to happen, all this debate will happen after the actual announcement. Is there any actual prospect that Australia could back out of this now?
That's hard to tell. That will take a decision by some future government. Nothing has been signed or sealed at this stage. It is very, very open-ended. It's more a hope than a promise, really. And until there is a firm design and a firm schedule of costings, all parties can decide that they'll step back from it. The United States could conceivably decide to step back from it because it doesn't want to release any of this technology to any other party, because that precedent, I don't think, has been thought through nearly well enough at this point. Mm. I think what Labor has done is simply to have indicated that it's not prepared to fight the next election on this issue. So it has simply said, oh, well, that's all very interesting. There may be a very good case for this. Let's see, because you've got this 18-month project going on and we'll find out what it says. Mm. What Labor has done is said, you know, we want to fight the next election on COVID and the economy. We don't want to be sidetracked in that. The Greens, though, have pointed out, and this is a really important thing, that this is not consistent with a country that has long taken an anti-nuclear stance, that is an anti-nuclear weapon stance and an anti-nuclear industry stance. So it is a pretty big change, and you might have thought that given that so many in our community do entertain quite strong views on this, a prudent government would have opened up the issue so that the community could have had a discussion about it, mm. would have opened it up so that there could have been positions taken in the parliament that we would all know about, and then perhaps proceeded to take a much more considered decision. But this certainly looks to me to be very rushed, and the fact that the Times of London reported on Saturday that only 10 people in Britain knew that this decision was coming, and at least on hearsay, very, very few people in Australia seem to have been aware of it. I mean, at the level of public officials, it's not just the community, I think, that's been blindsided. but the advising capacities of the Australian government have also been blindsided. Now, you can't really construct long-term policy on the basis of hopes and whims. It really does require deep long-term analysis and consideration and the proper bringing together of advising functions in the cabinet so that opportunities, costs, strategic aims, ambitions, all of those things can be brought to the table and can be considered.
Ben, it strikes me that we're seeing, you know, some of the immediate consequences now, but as much as this was a big announcement, the risks still seem to me to be quite big. And Alan's just talked there about, you know, the secrecy surrounding this deal. Do you think the fact that it was done behind closed doors means that perhaps even the government hasn't anticipated some of the problems coming down the line as a result of this deal?
Well, clearly they didn't. I mean, the diplomatic backlash was bigger than anticipated. They hadn't laid the groundwork there. According to reports in the US press, the United States thought dealing with France was Australia's responsibility, not theirs. And clearly that hasn't worked. And I think bigger picture, it's serving to confirm a really old-fashioned, what seemed to be an old-fashioned stereotype about Australia in our region. You know, that we've gone back to the United States and the United Kingdom, kind of outdated, outmoded, you know, strategy of the Anglosphere. You know, and it was decades ago that Bob Hawke first talked about Australia needing to find its security from within the region rather than outside the region. And this is such a throwback to that outside the region mentality that I think that has all sorts of consequences for how we engage with our Pacific neighbours, with neighbours in Asia that really have not been properly anticipated. And the groundwork clearly wasn't laid for because the discussions weren't held, as Alan has just outlined, across government, across policy circles, and certainly not with neighbouring countries.
Alan, just to finish with you, you and I have talked a lot about what we think of as the concept of security. Does this deal make Australia safer and more secure?
I don't think it does. I think what this does is to nail our long-term national security to the mast of US global interests, where the United States is constantly thinking about how it retains its own preeminence globally, which means that it has, generally speaking, a policy of security against its competitors. Now, we're not big enough to do that. We in Australia would maintain the security of our state much more effectively, I think, by looking at security with our neighbours rather than against them, and premising our long-term national security on the prosperity, the security and the well-being of our own citizens and the citizens who live in our neighbourhood. And it seems to me that if that were the starting point of our national security policy, we would not be buying nuclear-powered submarines.
Before we go, is there anything else that we've forgotten to cover that we should add?
Oh, about 20 zillion things, Eb, but...
Excellent. Thanks very much. That's all we've got time for today, and I'm sure we'll be discussing this for years to come. This episode was recorded on Tuesday, the 21st of September 2021, and things may have changed since recording. I'm not sure if the audio will pick this up, but if you can hear the lawnmower in the background, I do apologise, and it's the perils of recording from home in lockdown. You can visit australiainstitute.org.au for all our latest research, including Alan's analysis of the nuclear submarine deal. We're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Ben Oquist is at Ben Oquist, and Alan Beam is at Miranda Prothus. Our producer, Jennifer Macy, is at Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum, with additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Stay safe out there, get vaccinated as soon as you can, and thanks for listening.